is season 5 of Libya Matters. Join Elham Saudi, Mara Mohammed, Mara Ben Abdelrazak, and Mae Thompson for a Women, Peace and Security Takeover. This season, we'll reflect on topics including gender considerations, protections, women's rights, and our participation in political and peace processes. We'll be bringing you compelling conversations with women from Libya, Afghanistan, Iran, Sudan, and other global majority countries to help us think about not only the importance of upholding the Women, Peace and Security agenda, but also how to overcome current challenges and barriers to women in conflict and post-conflict settings.
For today's episode, you're joining me, Marwa Mohammed.
And me, Mae Thompson. It's good to be back. Today, we are talking about women in leadership, and we're taking a regional approach to do this. 2023 marked 20 years since the adoption of the Maputo Protocol to the African Charter on Human and People's Rights on the rights of women in Africa. At the time we're recording, 44 of 55 African Union member states have ratified the Maputo Protocol, with South Sudan being the latest to do so in June 2023. While ratification signals a commitment to gender equality, we still see across the continent that women's participation in peace processes and politics remains tokenistic and is often resisted by cultural norms. And when it comes to leadership roles, women are quite often still altogether missing. To take on this topic of women in African leadership, we are joined today by a gender, peace and security expert who joins a growing list of eminent South Africans in the justice and human rights world to join us on Libya Matters. Listeners may remember we had Yasmin Suka and Albie Sachs with us last season, and they are personally some of my favourite episodes, so I'm really excited for our conversation today. So should we get into it?
Yes, let's get started. I will start by introducing our guest today, Shuvai Busman-Nyoni. She is the executive director of the African Leadership Center based in Nairobi, Kenya. Prior to joining the center, she worked as the director of interventions for the Center for the Study of Violence and Reconciliation in Johannesburg, South Africa. She has worked extensively with a range of regional and national policymakers, civil society actors, and academics in post-conflict and transitional countries on the African continent. Shuvai is a gender advisor and investigator for sexual and gender-based violence as crimes in conflict and serves on the UN Women Justice Rapid Response roster for SGVB justice experts. Welcome, Shuvai, to Libya Matters, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
So let's get started. The Women, Peace and Security Agenda is a global framework that aims to promote the equal and meaningful participation of women in all aspects of peace and security, as well as to protect their rights and safety in conflict and post-conflict situations. However, the implementation of the WPS agenda faces many challenges and gaps, such as the lack of adequate funding, political will, most prominently, data accountability and coordination. To start off with, we'd like to hear from you when we're talking about women and girls in leadership, which is an important aspect to the WPS agenda. What does the term leadership mean to you? What does it look like in concrete terms?
Wow. Okay.
Jumping right in.
Yeah, jumping right in. That's a huge question. And I think, first of all, before we even think about the Women, Peace and Security agenda, for me, when I think about leadership, I am thinking about a set of processes, groups, a group, individuals, people who are exercising some kind of agency or capacity towards solving problems or solving situations that confront us as people, as humanity, and guiding us, walking with us, accompanying us and us as society towards some kind of solution or some kind of place where we can make sense of the situation or the problem or the crisis that we might be facing. And therefore, when I think about women, girls, female people or those who are usually excluded from such situations or making decisions about these crises or these wicked problems, I think we don't recognize the places or the context or the situations in which women are already exercising this leadership or already moving us towards some kind of solution or sense making of a crisis or something that may face us as society.
Interesting. Could you maybe take that just a little bit further, this concept of women naturally taking on this role that we don't necessarily recognize? Is it because we're looking at very traditional forms of leadership and so we're not seeing these elements?
I think yes, but also I think that we are often looking to a person, one person, who we will attribute leadership, we will attribute the success or the effectiveness of that one person's action or decision towards a particular outcome. And so trying not to say, oh, women are naturally leaders or women are naturally taking leadership, because it's true, they are, but not overemphasizing that point. But I think what we don't do enough of is recognize the spaces and the areas and the situations in which women, either as individuals or part of a group of individuals, are actually making a contribution to solving and making sense of situations. So it's less about seeing them, you know, seeing woman X sitting at a table, if we think about women, peace and security, making a decision on Y, but rather the processes and the sets of events that lead that woman to be sitting at that table and contributing to that conversation. I think if we thought less about individuals and how they exert themselves in a particular situation, and we saw, you know, just how different pieces of things come together, we would probably have a very different approach to leadership and understanding how situations could actually be transformed or changed. I don't know if that makes any sense.
No. I mean, that's kind of sparked so many different questions in my mind. I'd love to circle back to this later in terms of kind of the natural process and how we can consolidate that with the realities on the ground. But before we move there, I wanted to just kind of ask, in your experience, in which African countries do you work most heavily? And then how does leadership compare in the different country contexts that you work in? And how do they kind of manifest based on the different country contexts?
So, I mean, the work I do currently is focused on the entire continent. And so probably I would say I have interfaced with young people, young women coming from a variety of different countries, although with based in Kenya. So a lot of my work is in Kenya. Some of my work has also been in South Sudan and also in South Africa and Zimbabwe, which is my home country, country of my birth. So, yeah, and I think leadership generally manifests in different ways in those contexts. Very different ways, I think, but also a lot of similarities, I think, in the ways that questions that are being asked by society, by civilians, by citizens, about the way they're governed, about the way they're led, about the way solutions to their day-to-day challenges are being found or imagined, those answers from those who ought to be in leadership and ought to be making those decisions, I'd say there's similarities to different degrees. And a lot of a sense that these questions are not being answered satisfactorily and people are not living their lives and not having the best opportunity to live their lives to the fullest, especially young people, people who are coming out of university or, you know, people who want to contribute to their societies but are finding it very difficult too because the circumstances, whether socially, economically, are not allowing them to have that kind of clear path towards the future that they imagine. Yeah.
I found it really fascinating what you were saying about processes. I think, me personally, I hadn't thought about leadership in that way before. And I mean, thanks to organizations such as yourselves, it's great to hear that you're working so sort of broadly across the continent. I had sort of assumed that you would have picked a few, you know, contexts. So it's great that, you know, you can take such a sort of vast approach. And I think that sort of regional, international, transnational approaches is really important for this. And that we have seen in recent years more of an emphasis on women in leadership and the participation of women and women's organizations in peace building, in roles such as mediators and negotiators, and also in political transformation. The African Women Leadership Network's 5th annual intergenerational retreat was a mouthful, but it took place recently in the Republic of Congo with the objective to increase the representation of women in leadership positions in public and private sectors. And when I read about this retreat, I thought it was a great initiative, particularly the intergenerational aspect. But I paused when I read the word representation, and I think it sort of is similar to what you were saying between the difference between process and position. And of course, when we talk about inclusion as well. Yeah, and I wanted to ask you about your opinion on the dangers of using these types of words, representation, inclusion, quotas as well, in using this type of language and these sort of tools. If what are the dangers of that if there is no meaningful participation behind them?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question. The African Women Leadership Network is an important platform, I think, that has a lot of potential to do a lot of to advance the agenda, especially on the African continent, but also in ways that the rest of the globe can learn from, can emulate, can collaborate on. And I attended the first two intergenerational dialogues and worked with some of the intergenerational, I think they call it a scientific committee, who were coming up with how the methodology for how to hold this, which was also very, very interesting. A lot of interesting intergenerational exchanges on how both sides would want to see an exchange between, you know, between generations. But I mean, that would take us down a whole rabbit trail. But I think when we come to terms like inclusion, like representation, like participation, it is a bit dangerous to focus or become married to those terms, because we can use a tick box approach that we've included. So we have 5 women who are from West Africa, 5 women from, you know, then we have all the 5 regions of the African continent plus the diaspora represented. We can tick that box. We made sure that we had a variety of religions represented, and we tick the box. We had a variety of languages represented, and we tick that box, without doing the work of ensuring that representation or that participation or that inclusion has also a qualitative component to it. So what are those issues, or who are the communities, or what is the agenda or the narrative, the stories that those people are bringing, those women are bringing to the table? And it also then becomes very easy for something like the African Union, for instance, or other regional economic communities or organizations to report that gender inclusion or representation has happened, because we've had the women there. And of course, you don't want to buy into the whole numbers versus quality debate, because that also can take us down very dangerous roads. But the idea is, at what point are we constantly checking in to ensure that the various agendas, and the agendas change. Today, it really may be that we just need women at the table so we can hear women's voices. Tomorrow, it could be that we must make sure that the women who are there, we have younger women, we have women who are at the bridge, because those are usually left out. You know, the women who are not in their 20s, they're not in their 60s, but they are women too, and they're part of the community and the society. So the need will change because we are dynamic. We don't fit into very specific boxes. And I think oftentimes the conversation around inclusion, participation, representation keeps women especially in a box. And the moment you are outside of that box, then the organizations don't know how to handle you because you're a lawyer, but you are also an activist leading protests on the street, but you're also an academic who's publishing, and you're also a farmer. You know, so there's no space for you because how do we fit you into the agenda?
How do we start to break down that box? How do we ensure that what you were saying is, you know, practiced?
You know, I think it's difficult, but it's also easy. It's difficult because the work that we often do or that we see being done or the work that our colleagues in policy institutions, for instance, have to do is very specific. And yet life is lived, especially women's lives, are lived in very unspecific, very dynamic ways, right? And so to bring those two things together can seem quite impossible. But I think conversation and constantly being plugged in to where the women who are being brought to some of these spaces, the women who are being included again in the processes, ensuring that they are also constantly tapped into their communities, to the society, to the pulse really of what is going on. I mean, I've seen it working with NGOs, working with civil society, community-based organizations can often get very much dragged into the agenda of the policy space and where those high-level conversations are happening. And I think maybe the focus or the attention, if it's the other way around, that those policy colleagues have a way of being plugged into what is really happening in the community, in the society. And that probably has to happen through a lot of writing, a lot of exchange, a lot of sharing information, but not in the ways that we often think of. So writing a report, you know, what is your organization doing? And, you know, we met, these were our beneficiaries, X, Y, and Z. But finding ways alongside that, so not to trash that, but alongside that, where you can share the stories, you can share, this is what's changing, this is what is different, this is the language that is coming out of communities. Communities are not talking about, you know, impact. They're talking about, this is what happened to me when this and this situation, you know, came about. Yeah. The way we do our work, we're very much about intergenerational approaches and putting together or bringing together people who are experts, if you will, or but senior people, people who are seasoned, who have been doing what they've been doing for a long time, with younger people who are starting out. And so I found that people, mentors, we call them mentors in our programs, but they have been one of the greatest resources because there's a huge amount to learn from them, but they also learn in turn from interacting with the younger people.
This is very fascinating. I'm trying to kind of contextualize mm-hmm. it in the Libya context mm-hmm. now, right? Because this is obviously something that has been a long-standing debate within the post-conflict reconciliation. And right now, a lot of it is around ensuring that they're at the table. Mm-hmm. So like you said, mm-hmm. I think we're in the initial stages of we just need you there, but also making sure that there's that, it's not quantitative only, but there is kind of an added, you know, they're at the level, they're not an afterthought, they're not a box tick, mm-hmm. but they're actually there in those leadership roles. Mm-hmm. And I want to tie all of this together. But before, I think that one of the main challenges is when we look at the women in Libya and women human rights defenders, particularly in Libya, who are active actually in the public space, let's say, they continue to face intersecting and compounding challenges and vulnerabilities for the work that because of simply being in that public, occupying that public space. So the use of online violence is a perfect example of how it has been weaponized to target women for their activities. And it remains very prevalent in Libya as something that we as LFJL have also documented. So from your experience and looking more at the regional perspective and all the challenges that differ from one context to the other, but what are the challenges that face aspiring women leaders in extremely gendered political and social contexts? And how do you then, in reality, ensure that they are there?
Yeah, so gosh, the challenges. And I think, first of all, a lot of the different contexts, they remain very gendered in but maybe to differing degrees. So you might find in a context like Kenya, for instance, women are very present publicly, even in public office. A lot of the legislation enables women to occupy public office, to run for public office. But yet the cultural context still poses a lot of barriers and a lot of barriers for women that you think twice about your participation in public office. The same in my own country, Zimbabwe. A lot of enablers for women to occupy public space, but yet continued barriers. And if you take it to a context like South Sudan, the extent is different, but still the gendered nature of society, the very patriarchal nature of the society, would still have those same barriers for women's entry, etc. So I think a lot of the challenges revolve around what you have said, the gendered nature of society. So women's place, where you ought to be, where the culture dictates that you should be. In our rhetoric as a society or as a country, we present ourselves as being very advanced and very, you know, we want our women, we want the girl child to do well. But in practice, as soon as you want to run for public office, are you married or are you unmarried? As soon as you want to put your name in the ring, you are excluded from the meetings that happen at night after you've gone to bed, and you wake up the next morning. And this is an experience that a young woman in Kenya related to us in a particular leadership meeting, how she was the candidate for local elections in her party, went to bed at night, the next morning her male colleague had suddenly replaced her. And she had no idea about this meeting that had happened, you know, when she couldn't be, you know, at the meeting. So I think a lot of the challenges, especially where the narrative or the appearance of the cultural context is advanced and progressive, is a lot of times our male counterparts who know or ought to behave differently and ought to be part of advancing and ought to be collaborators in advancing the gender equality agenda, and who still enable the system to be unequal or unequal. But you touched also on violence. Violence is a huge, huge barrier, a huge challenge. So both the reality of bodily violence, whether it's by people you know or people unknown to you for various reasons, but also the violence of words and the violence of an image that can be created of you, about you as a woman who's doing particular things. I think another huge challenge, and we find this a lot in the South Sudanese context, where colleagues will say how from their own families or their community, their immediate community, that because they are doing certain things or taking a certain stance, they are then seen as bringing shame upon their community or their family because they are standing up for something. And then that creates a lot of challenges and discourages you from being out in the public spaces. And then I think just generally the opportunities that you're then confined to certain spaces, even as you would want to as you are doing the work of being a human rights defender or any kind of activism. These are the spaces that women should occupy. And as much as you might want to, move from just dealing with let's say, sexual and gender-based violence issues or human rights issues, and you want to work on economic crimes or economic rights or, go into the financial issues, because you're female or because you're a woman, you are not, that space is not given to you.
Yeah. I absolutely agree. And I think that we've seen the exact same scenarios play out with the Libya political dialogue and the women that participated in this process where, and this was run by the UN. So, I mean, I think that besides kind of these gendered societies, we also, what we would expect from the international mechanisms are also playing into this, and they're not ensuring the safeguarding that it is not enough to just bring a woman to the table and tick that box, but to have that active participation also means that you don't hold meetings in the middle of the night when, the woman has other obligations to the family, where they miss out on votes and conversations and participation. I'm always in awe on how it just doesn't dawn on those participating, but also, those that are convening as the UN or others. But I think that, the biggest challenge is that women are also hyper-scrutinized mm-hmm. in their role. So, the same activities that the male counterpart would take is they apologize for, and it's fine. But for a woman, she then is placed under the microscope, scrutinized, and then that's where a specific narrative will come out where there is the reputational damage or certain image presenting her in a certain image. And so then, unfortunately, you have some women that will choose to self-censor and not participate. And so we understand the challenges, but then how do we overcome these? How do we ensure that we are creating an environment that safeguards and allows women to participate, that encourages women and not only encourages, but ensures that women are part of that process. And I'd like to then kind of loop this back and string in the leadership conversation we had earlier and how our understanding or maybe our shifting our understanding of leadership within this context and how we can then marry the two for that kind of participation.
Mm. So I think a couple of things for me. The first one is building on the work that has already been done, because I think oftentimes the way we spend a lot more time than we ought to is getting something started. Yet there's a lot to learn from what has been done in many other contexts, and not only on the African continent, but in other regions as well. Latin America, Asia, we have examples of how bringing women to the table, the inclusion, the representation, the participation has been done. And therefore, what lessons we can learn for sustaining the momentum, because I think that's also one of the challenges. We seem to always be let's do a mapping about the women's movement, or let's map how women have been, but it's been done so many times. And why can't we just take what's there and learn from it, right? The second thing for me is it's linked to solidarity and how do we build solidarity in our own contexts, but also across contexts? And again, there's the learning there, because that's where that's where we will find our defenders, those who will stand up for us, stand up in our corners. I saw a very fascinating thing in the recent Zimbabwean election that happened in August. There's a lot of course, antagonism between ruling party, opposition party, etc. And there was, and I mean, this is linked to what you were talking about, online violence and online, you know, intimidation, harassment, etc., of women and women in leading roles, right? And one young woman who has, very young woman, who was appointed, I think, as a minister, and then other women who came out and started and asked certain questions about her, but very quickly the trolls, you know, the social media trolls jumped in, and it became very sexualized. The critique of her became very sexualized. But almost immediately, other women who were not from her same political party standing up to say, no, we do not accept this. This is not an acceptable way to critique women. Nobody is asking about the number of sexual partners that a man who was appointed as a minister has had. So for me, the solidarity is critical. So how we build solidarity within our context, outside of our context, but even with movements or groups that are not necessarily doing advocacy on issues that are our issues, but how can we find, intersections and synergy with, around those issues, which for me speaks very much about leadership, because leadership, again, won't be necessarily, or let's not look for it necessarily in a person, but can we demonstrate leadership in how we define and how we align ourselves with other movements, with other issues, in order for us to shine a light on our own. Just yesterday, we were having a conversation with colleagues around when you speak out about certain things as an organization or as an institution, when you haven't spoken out, for instance, on issues happening in your own context or in your own continent, right? And yet we have all these crises that are raging. So for me, I think taking it back to leadership is how we are awake even in our leadership journeys to other issues that may not be within our specific purview, but how we can connect with those in order to strengthen our own work on our issues.
Hello, I'm Rahima, Communications Officer at LFJL. In this LFJL Explains, I'll be delving into the topic of achieving equal and meaningful participation for women in political and peace processes. But what exactly does this look like? Achieving equal participation requires building an environment where women from different backgrounds and communities are actively feeding into all decision-making processes, policies, and initiatives, not just those that impact them and their rights, but the whole of society. In this way, the active and meaningful participation of women at all levels in post-conflict and transitional settings holds the potential to transform societies that are much more inclusive and accountable to all its people, and therefore sustainable. For example, in the years following the 1994 civil war and genocide in Rwanda, women played fundamental roles in the reconstruction and national reconciliation processes. In civil society, women established organizations for orphaned children and widows, and within political frameworks, they developed networks such as the Forum of Rwandan Women Parliamentarians in 1996, which helped to push through important legislation on gender-based violence and inheritance. Today, Rwanda is known for having the highest political representation of women globally, with just over 60% in parliamentary positions. To find out more about the participation of women in Libya's political process, check out our website, libyanjustice.org.
I love what you're saying there about solidarity, and I think that goes hand in hand as well with accountability, as sort of with our organization, everything that we do sort of goes back to accountability. But I think as lawyers, often maybe we miss out this solidarity aspect. And I think that it really is so crucial. I mean, I could listen to you talking about this for hours, but just to sort of maybe start to wrap up, I wanted to zoom out a little bit, and it kind of relates back to this sort of point on solidarity. But you were mentioning earlier around, it seems like the burden to ensure that we are moving forward to a more inclusive and sort of equal society where women are able to participate, it seems like the burden is very much on women to be countering sort of the shrinking space and the narratives and all of that. And something you mentioned earlier was that actually it's on our male colleagues as well to also be ensuring that they are holding themselves accountable and not, for example, conducting those meetings when their women colleagues can't be present. So, and I'm sure it must be frustrating for you and the work that you do working within a global environment where, you know, it still is very patriarchal and as much as you try to do the work, you can't forget that we're living in a society where, you know, these gender norms are still so ingrained. So yeah, maybe I can just ask you a final question to reflect on the importance of doing the work. Who should be doing the work? Is it important to sort of be providing the training and the mentorship to women and girls? Or do we need to address some larger sort of more existential systems first?
So I think my simple response is both and. We need to do both. We need to continue providing opportunities for young women. And the way in which we do that is not in the usual way. We can do all these leadership trainings. We can do all the workshops that we want to do for young women. And there is a proliferation, let me get that word right, of leadership initiatives, especially on the African continent. The question is the extent to which those programs, those initiatives do the work of intersecting with the path of a person's life, right? And so you're limited in the extent that you can do that kind of thing, because where you meet a particular person, etc., it plays into all of that. So we need to continue doing that, because for many young women, in spite of what I'm saying that, you know, it has to be deep work, etc., but for many young women, many young African women I've encountered, they may never, ever have that opportunity. They may never, the moment they encounter you, if it's in a workshop, if it's in a meeting, they may never meet a May, you know, in there. So that moment is an opportunity for them. And to that exposure can do so much for just the way they think about life and what they can do in the things that they've imagined and dreamt of doing. So that's one thing. The other is to constantly challenge our male colleagues. I remember being in a meeting once, and it was on the African Union's transitional justice policy, and it was a meeting for women who are working in transitional justice, and how, I think it was, you know, about how they can, you know, take up this policy in their work. And at the beginning of the meeting, when introductions were done, a whole lot of men were cited as having been part of the development of this policy. So I was involved in some of the development of this policy. So when it was my turn to do my session, I started out by actually listing and saying out the name of every single woman who was involved in that process. Every single woman. And for me, it was very important to make the point, especially in front of my male colleagues, that just by the way you conduct yourself, you erase women. Here you are in a women's meeting and you have erased the memory of women and their participation and their contribution completely. So for me, it's the continual reminder to our male counterparts, but also doing the work as women. And yes, the onus is on us, unfortunately, because of power dynamics, and they have the power to forget. But for us, we can't afford to forget. So when we can, we remind, we document, and we say those women's names over and over and over and over again. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, I feel so emotional just listening to you say that. And thank you so much for your work, for your activism, for fighting the good fight. I'm sitting here feeling so inspired. So we just have one more thing. It's meant to be a bit fun.
Okay.
So we have this little segment, we call it Debunking the Narrative, where we just pose a statement to our guest that is sort of a in the mainstream narrative for them to respond to Just your immediate response to it. So the statement that I have for you is this. Cultural norms regarding gender roles mean that women shouldn't be in leadership positions.
Huh. Oh, gosh.
I think even just that is fine. Even just that.
Total opposite. They mean women must be in leadership. Our cultural norms, especially on the African continent, women are in leadership. Yeah. They're making things happen.
I love that. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And just to kind of wrap this up, if you have any final thoughts that you want to share with us, although the whole thing was inspiring, but if there's any final thought that you want to share that we didn't cover in this, not to put you on the spot.
No, I mean, just to say, to really thank you for the opportunity and to say to the two of you, amazing women, just carry on doing what you're doing. And I'm glad your names are on this podcast. So your contribution will be remembered.
That's amazing. Thank you. Thank you. And so thank you for this. And I think that we have a lot to reflect on, from in terms of this discussion, but also how we can really take this and kind of reflect on that in the Libya context as well. And I know that, you know, at least for me, thinking about, you know, not reinventing the wheel, right? There is so much out there. So we don't need to do another mapping. but there are, you know, there are women out there that have already done the work that we can kind of take on and build from there. And so that's really my takeaway. So thank you so much. And I will be watching the great things you do moving forward as well.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate, review, and subscribe. You can find more information, including where to find us on social media, in the show notes. Libya Matters is brought to you by Lawyers for Justice in Libya and produced by Damiri Media. This season is hosted by Elham Saudi, Mara Mohammed, Mara Ben Abdelrazak, and Mae Thompson. It is produced and edited by Al Shaibani, with sound design and mixing from Havid Rebi. This season of Libya Matters was made possible by contributions from the LFJL team, including Alexandra Azua, Rahima Abdelrazak, and Hasna Al-Jamali.